This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. 1969 was a year of immense change. The first man landed on the moon. Hippies converged on Woodstock. Civil rights leader Fred Hampton was murdered. And the first draft lottery was held for the Vietnam War. Millions of Americans watched to see if they or their loved ones would be drafted to fight in an increasingly unpopular war through a system that many viewed as unfair. As Creedence Clearwater Revival would declare that same year, "I ain't no millionaire son. I ain't no fortunate one." The new musical, Fortunate Sons, is a snapshot of the social change happening at that moment through the eyes of a family in Middle America. The show premieres this Friday at Milwaukee's Skylight Music Theater as a virtual staged reading. It features music by Paul Williams, a composer known for his pop hits like Rainbow Connection and an old-fashioned love song. He's also a man who lived through the draft. He joins me now along with one of the playwrights, Eric Cohen, and the director of the show, Michael Unger. Paul, Eric, Michael, thank you all so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Great to be here.
Thanks for having us.
How did this project really get started?
The idea was brought to me by Mark Madnick, who is my co-book writer on this, and it was a subject that I was unfamiliar with, that this draft happened. I mean, I was born in the mid-60s, but wasn't really aware much of Vietnam. And it's interesting, most ideas and stories don't lend themselves to musicals because people breaking out in song is a very specific kind of art form. But this subject really seemed to be perfect for the stage and for a musical. And so it seemed like a good idea, and we started developing it from there.
Paul, you were a part of the draft, much as any man was at that time. What was that experience like for you?
Terrifying. I opposed the war. I did not believe that we had any business in Vietnam. As the years have passed, I've come to have a great deal of even more respect than I did at the time for the people that did serve. Incidentally, one of the things that I'm most excited about what we've created here, with the brilliance of Eric and Mark's script, is that it really honors both sides of this argument, the people that went, the people that didn't go, because it would have been morally just unacceptable for them. There was a morality that was a part of my decision, but there was also a fear-based dedication to not going. As a matter of fact, I got my weight under 100 pounds when I found out I was tall enough to go off and serve. So when I read the script, you know, I felt the pressure of that bizarre lottery. You know, what happens if they call, you know, your birth date? I knew people that served, you know, and some that came back and some that didn't. And it's a remarkable place in our history. And one of the things that impressed me is that some of the difficulties, some of the obstacles to having a full and fair life in 1969 are speed bumps in everyday life in 2021. So I thought it was a perfect story, a chance to look back with a dash of sentimentality, but with the stark reality that the problems these families are facing are not unlike what families all across America are facing right now.
It is such an interesting time to be revisiting this moment in our history. My father, actually, his number was called, but luckily or unluckily, he had recently dislocated his shoulder, and so he was not eventually drafted, but he would talk about that time of his life in a very conflicted way. And it seems like this show speaks to that experience. How do you dive into a topic like this that is so full of emotion on both sides, so full of these deep-rooted beliefs?
Yeah, for us, you know, we started from, I think, the most logical place, which was who would be most affected by the draft, and that was draft age men. So in this case, it was everybody who was born between 1944 and 1950. You know, it seemed logical to get a group of them together on this night to watch their fate on television, which in and of itself is strange and something that we kept thinking about. And I've said that it's, you know, it was like the first worst reality show. I mean, if you take it all the way up to modern times, we have these sort of competition shows all the time now. It's commonplace, everything from The Bachelor to, you know, American Idol. So there was that undercurrent of, wow, people really sat down to watch and find out if they were going to go to Vietnam. So, you know, we started out with these group of three or four guys who were all of draft age and all fully eligible. So 1A. And then we just sort of built a few ancillary characters around them. But as we were developing the piece, even before Paul came on board, we sort of realized that it would be most powerful as an ensemble. So to add their parents and a sister for two of these brothers, and then, you know, another friend, and just find a way to connect them all in ways that went beyond the draft. So that was sort of where we started from and just sort of started layering onto that.
I think one of the things that is so compelling about it is observing the relationships between the family members and all the other things that they're dealing with. They were massive in the time as far as, you know, something that we take for granted these days, like a mixed race relationships, to think that in 1969, that in the middle America, that could be something massive to have to deal with. The dialogue in this book, this is the most amazingly natural, all-involving dialogue I think I've ever read. And I've written a few shows, or provided songs for a few shows through the years. This was unique.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's definitely a beautiful slice of life. And the first thing that I latched onto when I read it was how much we become engaged and involved in this family story and their ancillary characters that surround this living room or this basement with the TV. Paul's absolutely right in how, you know, it's a sort of a cross-section of society. It's a family like smack dab in the middle of America. But of course, you can extrapolate this out. This happened to so many, you know, millions of families. But you learn so much about this particular family as representative of perhaps most of America at the time. But you really fall in love with the characters. And it is an ensemble piece. There's no one that sticks out more than the other. So it's a really well-crafted book, I think. And Paul's music, well, it's Paul's music, so that's going to be wonderful no matter what. The lyrics are smart, and it's a really nice insight into a slice of time and a slice of life that I didn't know about. I was 9 at the time. We're very proud to bring it to Skylight. I've worked with Eric and Mark before. It's one of the things I'm most excited about doing here as the artistic director at Skylight, is to bring new works in.
Yeah. Now, Paul, you touched on this a bit, but I think people will be very familiar with your work as a composer outside of the musical theater realm a bit. The Rainbow Connection, Rainy Days and Mondays, or An Old-Fashioned Love Song. How does your work with Fortunate Sons compare and in some ways contrast with work that people may be more familiar with?
The script is the Bible. That's the Holy Grail, the characters. And one of the big major mistakes that a lot of songwriters, and probably myself at times, have made is leaping into a project like this and go, oh, this is a great chance to write a 60s sounding hit. That's not what's called for. What's called for is to do basically two things, you know, as a composer and a lyricist. When you're interrupting somebody's beautiful play, it better be with something that either advances the story or it gives you a peek into the inner life of the characters, you know. So I've spent my entire life writing codependent anthems. I mean, I've always joked, I won't last a day without you is not a healthy thought. And you know, I'm a very romantic fellow. I'm somebody who is also intensely sentimental. I head out in the country with Three Dog Night, and we've only just begun with The Carpenters, were my first two hits. And at the time, Inagata DeVita was the number one album in the country. So it was so against the grain of what was commercial at the time. And what I realized is that sometimes if I write from the center of my chest, which is not witty, it's not an intellectual exercise, but it's kind of a therapy for, you know, me to sort of confess, pick me up and love me. I'm nothing without you, mommy. You know, if I put that in a song, there are people all over the world that feel like that. And it's not the hippest, you know, and it's not the most current, but it's constant. I mean that, and I imagine all the people that are lucky enough to hear you, Joy, and connect with the kind of conversation that, you know, that you encourage. There's a little drain of the loneliness and the cabin fever out of that. And I think that this particular story provides so many little opportunities to speak to what's going on inside somebody's head and heart.
It's interesting to explore this idea of connection and of ultimately vulnerability at a time when so many of us feel disconnected, so many of us feel isolated in a variety of ways. What do you hope audiences take with them from this experience, from this virtual experience, of course, but from the work that you're presenting them?
You know, for me, I think what's fascinating is for this particular work, even though it's now on 50 years ago, I think the idea of a shared experience for a family, even something that was, you know, potentially horrific or, you know, something that would rip the family apart, I think is something that most families today are not quite as familiar with. This idea that anybody ever gets together in front of a television to watch something at the same time, I don't think is that commonplace anymore. I mean, I have, you know, a 20-year-old and an 18-year-old, and they're watching shows on their phones. My wife and I are watching it somewhere else. So I can't remember the last time we were all together watching something. So I think for me, if people can take in, even in a sort of dramatic setting, what it meant to be a family together, I think that would be kind of really good, because I think it's lost in some way where we're at as a society now.
You know, I'll jump in and just say that one of the things that was unique to that time is we would sit at our, you know, in front of the television with our TV trays and watch the evening news. And we were watching, you know, fresh footage from Vietnam. It was a horror show. But with the repeated exposure to that violence and that great loss of life and limb, I think in some ways it began to dull the senses and news became entertainment. And I think that there was a certain point where the horror of what we were seeing became commonplace. One of the things that happened to us in the last 9 months, 10 months, is because of this horrific virus, we were all captive audiences that observed Floyd's murder, the knee on the neck, and we could not turn away. We could not turn away. And it, one of the most massive changes in attitudes and opinions and activism occurred because of what we saw. Wherever you land on it, or whatever, that was unacceptable. And people responded. And I think that there is a connection between what we observe as a collective unit, whether it's people around the world, the people that observe that horrible act, or a family watching, you know, young men die, you know, for a war that perhaps we should never have been in. And all that being said, I have to tell you that my respect, and this shows respect for the veterans who went because they were asked to and because they love their country. And when their country says go, that you go. I think that there's something that deserves to be seen in Fortunate Sons.
That's a tough act to follow, Paul, but I love historical fiction as a way to teach us about our world. People high up on the hill made this decision to randomly pick a bunch of birth dates out of a spinning, you know, thing full of blue capsules. And part of the impact of this piece for me is I know those people who made those decisions felt they had to for their whatever reason, democracy, of course, but do they really know on the micro level how it affected the American family? I come from a very close-knit family, three kids just like the Willett family. And to see how profoundly it impacts for the proud and the terrified, I think is a really important lesson for us all to learn. And theater as a teaching tool to me is one of the greatest gifts of the job that I do. And I think we can learn a little bit about compassion, empathy, which, you know, this world needs now always and, you know, more than ever, because that's been tested incredibly harshly over the past many months. So it's a lesson in all those positive things without actually telling you which way to think. You know, that's one of the gifts of the understanding both sides of the equation, as Paul said.
Yeah. Well, Michael, Paul, Eric, thank you all so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Great pleasure. Thank you, Joy.
Thank you, Joy.
Paul Williams is a composer known for his songs Rainbow Connection, Rainy Days and Mondays, and an old-fashioned love song, among many others. Eric Cohen is one of the playwrights behind Fortunate Sons, and Michael Unger is the director of the play and the artistic director of Skylight Music Theater, where the musical is premiering this weekend. The staged reading will be streaming this Friday and Saturday at 8:30, and you can find more information at wuwm.com.